Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. Want to play Wheel of Fortune anytime on your television set without requiring a video game console nearby? Well, if you have Roku, you can. That's the latest advancement from interactive TV venture PlayWorks. Chief Executive Jonathan Boltax joins me next in Interradio Exclusive Live from Israel. Time-tunneling drama The Lazarus Project is TNT's new hit series. Coming up, time well spent with executive producer Joe Barton, another Interradio Exclusive Live from England. And why do so many TV series have a short one season or less life? Our final guest, Pabst and Jenis, explores that inquiry through his popular YouTube attraction, 13 Week Theater. We'll meet him over our final 30 minutes. Also ahead, Food Network breaks up with Restaurant Impossible, Roku makes a marriage pact, Ocean Life Network surfaces, and our classic trivia question. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and TuneIn Radio, and present on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network, the Zencast, the Creator Network, and other leading podcast destinations. This just in, happy birthday, Noah, and tomorrow will be televised. Good Monday afternoon to you and all. Welcome once again to the program all about TV's current and future 90-minute edition in store for you. We got a great one for you. And off the bat, I want to wish my sister Stephanie's youngest son, Noah, a very happy B-Day today. And if you have a B-Day today, congratulations to you. This is a program where we want you involved with our guests. How? You pick up the phone, you dial in, and you use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The numbers get anywhere you're catching us across the country or around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, or TuneIn Radio. You can also use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. You'll find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Use the phone or the room. Either way, you're involved with our guests. And while the program is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon, your Blog Talk Radio speaker to the screen. Follow the instructions. Other people can be live with you. PlayWorks Chief Executive Jonathan Boltax joins us live from Israel after these news notes. Time has run out on Restaurant Impossible, Food Network's long-running series where failing eateries and their owners get a second chance at success through a 48-hour makeover. Host Robert Irvine put out a series of tweets allowing that outcome earlier today, adding that he's working already on new TV series ideas. Food Network confirmed the end of Irvine's series earlier this afternoon. Restaurant Impossible launched in 2011, continued until 2016, and returned to Food Network's lineup 4 years ago, the last of 191 episodes played this past April. Another Roku unscripted series will premiere August 4th in The Marriage Pact. Five couples determine if they will fulfill or break a vow to unite for better or worse by a particular age, with help from relationship expert Sean Woodruff. Boat Rocker Media subsidiary Maven is producing the 8-episode series. Get ready for a 24/7 under-the-sea viewing venture. New service Ocean Life Network is set to dive into smart TV waters October 15th. A third of the more than 30 series running at the start will be originals. The rest will be creator-influencer co-productions. The ad-supported adventure will be overseen and funded by Richard Wolpert, the former head of Disney Online. Now, quickies. Max will debut the second season of Issa Rae-produced comedy series Rap Beat August 10th. We can't say the other word, otherwise we'll be off the air. Classic-centric channel MeTV has landed national carriage on DirecTV. Hulu is creating Annie Mayhem, a new section of its service devoted to adult-centric toon series and anime. More than 21,000 episodes will be available to watch from the start. Jimmy Kimmel-owned outlet Wheelhouse, whose latest series is Secret Chef, featured last month on this very program, will expand its relationship with Secret Chef leader David Chang. This joint enterprise will develop unscripted fare, home and lifestyle series, plus segments for Chang's new net Majordomo TV running on LG smart TV sets. And you can add one more tune item before moving on. Propopolis will finally arrive on Fox September 24th. The ancient Greek set creation of Dan Harmon already has the go for two more seasons. And that is news notes for today. And now joining us live from Israel, an Interradio exclusive, the chief executive of interactive TV service PlayWorks, Jonathan Boltax. Jonathan, welcome into our program.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
It is a pleasure, very much too. So Wheel of Fortune is now available on Roku the last couple of weeks. How's it doing?
It's doing great. First of all, I encourage everyone to play the game. It's quite simple. If you go to Roku, you can either do a voice search for Wheel of Fortune or go to the games menu and check it out. Well, I think it's important because it really shows how you could take, first of all, a storied and iconic brand like Wheel of Fortune, and you can use it and turn it into a CTV-based game using your existing remote control. And it's fun. It's addictive. It has the feeling of the TV show. And, yeah, we're seeing really, really great early results.
For people who don't have Roku, if they have other smart TV sets, smart devices, when will they get Wheel of Fortune?
Good question. So oftentimes what's interesting about Playworks is we have a proprietary engine that allows us to distribute to many platforms. However, we usually do one set of platforms first. So either we do an HTML5 build, and that will allow us to get probably to a wider set of platforms like Vizio and LG and Samsung and many of the cable and satellite operators. Roku is its own individual beast with their own proprietary markup language called BrightScript. So sometimes we make a decision to do Roku first. It's a great platform. In this case, we did Roku first, and hopefully in the next couple of months you'll see Wheel of Fortune on many of those other platforms that I just mentioned.
Dr. Northwest Media, one of our super fans on our chat room, just came in, gave us a thumbs up. So thanks for coming in, Dr. Northwest Media. If you have a question or comment, put it in the room or give us a call, 646-652-2906. Is it fair to say, Jonathan, that at long last we are finally seeing interactive games available on the television set, and you don't need a PlayStation, you don't need an Xbox, you don't need a video game console on the set, you just use your voice remote, or your remote control, or even body language. Is it fair to say that finally we have arrived at the beginning of this era?
Yeah, I think we are, as Simon, I think we've known each other for a while. I've been doing this for, wow, close to 25 years, and we've been waiting for that moment for a long time, and I think we're already in it. I think we're already in it. With the proliferation of smart TVs, with the proliferation of what we call OTT devices, in our mind, that's devices like Roku and Amazon, and with even the cable satellite operators getting smarter with their services and set-top boxes, today, gaming on your TV and interactive content on your TV is well entrenched and well established.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about Samsung and LG launching game hubs, which allow you to play all sorts of games on your television set, again, without the console? For example, when Samsung showcased their game hub at the Interactive Ad Bureau's Playfronts here in New York earlier this year, they were mobbed in terms of visitors coming to see what they're doing. People were playing things like Fortnite. We understand the Twitch, the Amazon service, that is available on Samsung Smart TV hubs, maybe on LGs. It seems that it is surprising a lot of people in terms of not only how much these games are being played on these various TV sets and devices, but also who is playing them, like Gen Z, like millennials, like Gen Y, and so on.
Right. So first of all, this is a great phenomenon. Playworks likes to see as much interactivity from any type of content, any type of distributor, any set-top box, television, et cetera. I think there's a couple of things happening here. One, the gaming industry is very broad, and there's no longer a niche industry. So gaming today hits every demographic, whether it be a young child or whether it be a 75, 85, 95-year-old man or lady. And so what we're seeing is both casual gaming taking place on these smart TVs, this is what we do, and now we're seeing other types of gaming, which is attracting other audiences, such as more hardcore gaming on the Samsung hub. One of the tenets that we have is that we believe that it is very important for it to be the simplest possible experience. So we're catering to people who don't want to hook up their smartphone and pair it. They don't want to get a Bluetooth remote control. Our games are geared to using your existing remote control. So you got your up, down, left, right, select, maybe a couple of buttons, even if maybe even not. And our games are catered for those people who just want to see the game, get in the game, play the game, and have fun. And although many of these games are called casual games in the industry, they're certainly not played casually. So we see, you know, north of 20 minutes average sessions. And so the Samsung Hub is great, and I hope, I don't know actual numbers of people using it, but we think it's we certainly hope it's a huge success, and we also hope it's a springboard for also access to casual gaming, which is really the largest gaming category in the world.
You're hearing Jonathan Voltax. He is the Chief Executive Officer of Playworks, the interactive TV game and other things service that is available on smart TV sets, smart devices, multi-channel bundles too. And one of the services you can get or games you can get is now Wheel of Fortune if you have Roku, and hopefully soon other smart TV products as well. Jonathan joins us live from Israel this half hour on Tomorrow Televised. He has a sort of bi-unique situation because he has offices in New York and in Israel as well. That's where we get him today, from Israel, this half hour on Tomorrow Televised. Tom, I'm with you live from New York. Good to have you with us. 8 degrees at the top of the hour. Let's hear from you. Give us a call, 646-652-2906. Or use the chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name, Duck Northwest Media already in the room. First of two episodes this week. Coming away on Friday, we will talk about a new venture that is uniting independent programmers who are using smart TV sets and devices and multi-channel phones to reach you. It's called the Independent Streaming Alliance. And one of the key players is Reverie, the Gay and Lesbian Programming Network. He's been on the show before. Damian Pellicone, one of the co-founders and chief executive officer of Reverie, he will be with us live as one of our guests. That's Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, here on Tomorrow Televised. And stay tuned. Later this half hour, we have a very big guest announcement for who's coming your way as our lead guest next Monday. Jonathan, this is just a little bit, the Wheel of Fortune game, of what Playworks does. You have been on a roll in terms of introducing all sorts of new interactive services. How many games does Playworks have? And I understand that you have different channels for different smart TV products.
Yeah, so Playworks was founded 5 years ago, and we founded as a as we wanted to take CTV gaming and bring it to the world, and that's where we started. And thank God, over a couple of years later, we found ourselves with over 100 games in our catalog, and we found people are playing our games. Sort of what happened about 2 years ago, maybe 2.5 years ago now, that not only were people now playing our games, but a key thing happened, which is CTV programmatic advertising started to become a reality. So, Simon, that was a huge thing for us. It's all of a sudden we were able to now take our games and insert 15 to 30 second full video, beautiful advertising within those games, get a premium CPM, and all of a sudden turn this into a very, very interesting business. At some point on the way, we asked ourselves, you know, what else should we be doing on the TV? Playworks has great distribution. We're live on Sky and Comcast and Shaw and Videotron and Samsung and Vizio and LG and others. But what else should we be doing on the TV? And we had this big idea that we should be doing TV on the TV. And that's when we asked ourselves, what is TV on the TV? What kind of content should we do? And it was a very obvious decision for us. It was what we feel is the future of a lot of TV content is YouTubers. And we started to license YouTubers, and we started to recreate their content and repackage their content for television. So today, Playworks not only has over, like, I think close to now 200 games developed for CTV in the catalog, but we also have over 100 AVOD apps from some of the biggest YouTubers in the world. And along with that, we also have now 3 FAST channels as well. So we've become, in our own little way, we've become our own media moguls on CTV, and we really leverage all 3 of them. I'll give you one nice example. So we work with the Ninja Kids. I don't know if you ever heard of them, but the Ninja Kids actually just won Nickelodeon's 2023 Social Media Family of the Year. So they're very big YouTubers. I think over 20 million subscribers. They're getting north of 750,000 to way over 1 million views in, let's say, 72 hours on their YouTube channel. We've taken their content. We've repackaged their content. But also we have a game. We have a Ninja Kids. It's called Ninja Kids the Game. And from that game, there's a videos button, and in that videos button, you can click it, and you can get access to over 500 Ninja Kids videos that have been, again, repackaged for television. So we create this kind of funnel and vortex that allows viewers who like the Ninja Kids to now watch it and then play it and back and forth. And we'll be doing that with other creators as well as this year progresses.
There's 2 other, as you mentioned, services you're putting on. One is called BRB Travel Plus Food. And then you are working mm-hmm. with a very popular young YouTube star named like Nastya. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about those. Mm-hmm. Let's start first with travel plus food. Sounds very yummy.
Yeah, it is. VRB, be right back. Travel and food is one of our three pillars of our video strategy. And what we like to say with VRB, it's a tagline is live a little. And it's the idea is to unplug from the daily grind with off-the-grid experiences, unique tastes, memorable moments, and we're bringing new voices. These are a whole host of different social media creators we're bringing, like Finding Alini and Anna and Ian, Ryan Van Duzer and others. And from this content, we're creating very, very unique content for within the food and travel genre, and it's very different than what's out there. It's content that you really it's not, hey, look at me and this is how you make a cake, or it's not a cake show with that who makes the best cake. It's really experiential. It's going with Malini to the Amalfi Coast and experiencing the villages of Italy with her. It's all done beautifully. You know, sometimes people think creator content and they think it's, you know, it's just like, you know, shaky camera. This stuff is A-plus content. And today really getting off the ground with some great shows and has, like you said, an AVOD app and also an accompanying FAST channel. So it's our newest creation in the video space. So we look forward to hopefully really positive results.
Have you thought about, for the food segments, making them interactive by, for example, the opportunity to showcase recipes on the screen and to go like step by step so that if somebody wanted to use that recipe, they could call it up at any time? When Food Network had their interactive service, that was one of their big elements, was the ability to have a library of thousands of recipes at somebody's touch of a finger.
Right. So it's a good question. So I don't want to say something sacrilegious about it, and I'm all in on interactivity, but I don't think the content always needs to be synchronous content, meaning that just because I'm watching someone on TV eating, you know, this chicken sandwich that I then need automatically need to know, you know, the recipe for it. I think TV still can be consumed and digested, no pun intended, without those very synchronous moments. I fully believe, though, in asynchronous interactivity, where it's doing things maybe on the same screen that's maybe not related to the show, maybe playing Tetris while you're watching a food show. That we're all in on, and we actually will also be having some very interesting announcements around that as the year rolls around. So I don't know. What do you think about that, Simon? You think that's you think you really want that interactivity?
Well, you know, one of the things that Food Network a number of years ago was doing this is that this was an all-in interactive project. We have not heard a lot about it lately. Mm-hmm. It seems to have sort of, I hope I'm wrong, but mm-hmm. it's sort of over the last couple of years since, and certainly since Warner Brothers has and Discovery have connected, they've tied the knot, that it seems to be either mm-hmm. dead or sort of lying on the vine. But I think there's an opportunity here for a recipe interactive service. Whether it's tied into mm-hmm. a specific project or not, the ability to call up recipes and, you know, play with them step by step, you know, using your voice or
right.
voice remote, that kind of thing is certainly now with artificial intelligence, it's certainly an option.
So I would agree. Again, you could use interactivity on television for so many different things, and TVs being in so many different rooms as well allows for, you know, a cornucopia of options. But I would suggest that maybe not have it tied necessarily to the show, but maybe it being broader, like you said. So if you wanted to have a recipe, it should be every recipe. It doesn't necessarily need to be the recipe that you're watching on the screen. That could be part and parcel of it, but it doesn't need to be only that.
Talk about the YouTube star that you're working with, this child attraction that that now has her own channel.
Sure. Sure. So we're fortunate to work with Like Nastia. Like Nastia is, I believe, the sixth largest YouTuber currently in the world. Her own personal YouTube channel has over 105 million subscribers. And if you combine all of her channels, I believe it's over 300 million subscribers. So she for sure is a sensation. I think actually also Hollywood Reporter recently, within the past month, named her one of the 75 most influential kids in Hollywood. which is also quite remarkable. And we have just started the rollout of her AVOD app, and that is starting to proliferate off to many of our different partners. And also you can find her as well on our PW Kids Fast Channel. So she's a real anchor of that Fast Channel that is also rolling out to more and more distributors. And, yeah, it's fun. It's educational. It's really, really well-produced content. And she obviously resonates with over 100 million people. So we're very fortunate to work with her. We're just getting her content out there and off the ground. So we really look forward to a tremendous success, and we feel very fortunate to be able to distribute her content.
One of the game projects, Jonathan, that you announced recently deals with one of the greatest musicians of all time, Jimi Hendrix. And I understand it's both – it's called the Jimi Hendrix Experience, and it deals both with trivia games but also with something that's – if you watch a lot of TV and you see these ads for Slotomania or Thisomania, whatever, you are now doing Slack games.
Right. Okay, cool. Wow, you're on the ball. You've been watching us a little bit. So, yes, so, again, we've been very fortunate to work with Jimi Hendrix. And slots is a very, very big and important category in mobile gaming. Slotomania is one of the biggest revenue-generating games year over year. And we felt we have a couple of slot games already live on Roku. Slots XL, and then called Slots TV. We actually have a Pink Panther slots as well. And these all performed pretty well, and we decided to look at some of the more successful slot machines that are more traditional slot machines on casino floors, and Jimi Hendrix was one of them, and that resonated with us, and we reached out with them, and we have a partnership, and that's also today live on Roku, so you could play that game. You could play slots. And one of the differences, Simon, between this game and some of the other games we've been speaking about or other applications we've been speaking about is this one very much relies on in-app purchase as its monetization engine. So I would say, 90% of our revenue is from programmatic advertising. But in this case, really for a good slots game to work, you really need the tension of the in-app purchase experience. So this game is really thrives on in-app purchase, and there are nice platforms like Roku really being one of the leaders that allows for a very seamless in-app purchase experience. So you can play for free always, but if you want to buy tokens or advance maybe a little quicker, you have the ability to buy token packages and play even more.
We're talking about PlayWorks. It's the interactive TV service available in all sorts of different ways on smart TV sets and smart TV devices. We're talking with Jonathan Botak, the Chief Executive Officer of the venture, live from Israel this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. And if you have a question or comment for him in our remaining minutes, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name. One of the most awaited programs of this summer, and particularly this month of July, is coming up next week. It is the return of the Peabody Award-winning series Justified in an update version called City Primeval. Next Monday on Tomorrow Be Televised, my lead guest will be the prolific producer and director and the executive producer and showrunner of City Primeval, Michael Dinner. He'll join us live from England. That's Michael Dinner, the prolific producer and director of Justified, City Primeval, our lead guest, a week from today right here on Tomorrow Be Televised. Since the Wheel of Fortune rollout with Roku, have you heard from Sony, Fremantle, other game show producers about expanding your relationship? Maybe having an interactive TV version of Jeopardy, Family Feud, Price is Right, Let's Make a Deal, and so on and so on.
So I'm not going to comment directly on that, but I think we believe very strongly that TV brands resonate very well on the TV, so I shouldn't be a surprise. And I think you'll start seeing some more announcements from us as the year goes along of not only maybe other gaming brands, but maybe other very, very well-known TV brands and games around those from PlayWorks. So although we still are very focused and believe in sort of the traditional casual gaming space, whether that be word games or puzzle games or simple hyper-casual games. We are also believe that games that revolve around IP that people recognize and what they're used to seeing on their TV will allow for sort of greater recognition, and maybe they'll be more incentivized to click and try and play and then play more and more and more.
By the way, are you surprised that Sony, which is also a smart TV set maker, and they're the owners of Game Show Network, and they have now, in the last couple of years, really put on a whole bunch of new games that have caught on with people like Masterminds, or recently Switch, the revival of Split Second, now Hey Yahoo with Tom Cavanaugh, when we were there on NBC, that they have not been involved in the interactive TV realm, or they've sort of steered clear from it?
That is surprising, to be honest. They should be in touch with us, because I think it one of the beautiful things about creating games on TV is it extends the entertainment experience, right? So if I watch, actually I saw a wonderful quote, although it was related to movies, I believe it was from Deloitte, that said that 60% of the people who go to a movie and see a movie, they actually want to play or look for, is there a video gaming experience? So this came out within the last couple of months. So 60% of the people wish more of their favorite movies and TV shows also had video gaming experiences from the survey that Deloitte did. It's a huge number, right? You see Super Mario Brothers movie generated, wow, I don't know how many, it's more than $2 billion already, but certainly it was over $1 billion. So there's a strong connection between gaming and media, and for someone who has a network and they can watch the show, they have there's a proclivity there that they want to keep on interacting with it after the show. So to me, that makes perfect sense, and you know, we should definitely be working together, them and others.
Yeah. Jonathan, you've been part of this interactive TV scene, as you said, for a quarter century. Where do you think we are going? It seems that we may be very close to seeing the era of video commerce begin, where you can order products and services through your television set and pay for it that way. We're seeing some experiment in tele-education on the television set, telehealth on the television set. There was talk that at some point the TV set is going to become a hub for smart home operations, where you can check your air conditioning, interact with your washing machine or your refrigerator, freezer, et cetera, et cetera. Where are we at in terms of interactivity becoming more of a major part of the TV life?
Right. I remember not too long ago, less than a couple of years ago, someone would say, put a camera on my TV? No way. There was no way that I would ever allow, or any TV manufacturer will put a camera on their TV, because that means that they can see into the living room and so on and so forth. And today you're starting to see, you know, what is a logical application is, let's say, something like Zoom on your TV. It's just perfect. And then once you have a camera attached, you could start doing some really interesting things. You could do things like co-viewing. I could be watching, I could be sitting here in Israel and you could be New York and we could be watching hopefully the Mets win tonight. And on and on. So I believe that the living room is still and will always be the central hub of entertainment, as well as even utility in the home. And these types of applications and usages and use cases that you just mentioned are going to come pouring in. It's been a trickle for a very long time, but I think we're going to start seeing the Niagara Falls of TV interactivity shortly.
And let's not forget Telly, the free television set that's going out to as many as 500,000 people for free, which we had one of the key people on about a month ago. And we're, by the way, trying to arrange to see a demo of this. Has a webcam, has a camera in the TV set where you can do video
Great.
Chat.
Amazing.
And they may not be
Amazing.
The only one, so we'll see what happens there. Before you go, are there any other new either ad video on demand networks or fast channels that will be coming from Playworks, let's say, over the second half of this year?
So, yes, yeah, so nothing that we're talking about right now, but as mentioned, you can stay tuned for some very, very interesting games around other TV brands that we hope to roll out in the next quarter or two. And we'll continue to be building out and adding new content and shows and creators to some of our video pillars, which is the BRB, the Travel and Food Channel, as well as PW Kids and Ninja Kids TV. And the other thing is that is really important you'll be seeing from us is more and more games from some of the creators that we're working with on the video side. So there'll be this expanded experience where I can watch video content and then play with same brands of those video content. So those are things that we're very focused on in the second half of 2023.
Playworks and its assortment of interactive TV games and services are available on many smart TV sets and smart devices. Once again, if you want to play Wheel of Fortune 24/7 on your TV set, you can do that through Roku. More details about what Playworks does and what it's got coming up, here's where you go online, www.play.works, W-O-R-K-S. That's www.play.works. Jonathan Boltax, Chief Executive of Playworks, joining us live from Israel. Thank you again for joining us. We wanted to have you on for a very long time. Happy we finally did this half hour. All the very best to you and your future ventures, and we'd love to have you back on anytime you like.
Thank you so much. This is a real pleasure, and thank you for also all the work you're doing for the industry. Much appreciated, and I look forward to the next time we can connect.
You're very, very welcome, Jonathan. It's a pleasure all the way. Take care. Have a great week.
Okay. All the best. Goodbye.
Jonathan Boltax from Playworks joining us live in a very exclusive interview from Israel. When we come back, TNT has got a hit new series in the Logix Project, and we will have its executive producer, Joe Barton, live from Brighton, England, plus our new classic trivia question. And then at the top of the hour, we'll have Pab Sengenis. He is the host and originator of the fast-growing YouTube attraction, 13-Week Theater. All that coming away in the hour ahead, which starts after the pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. This is the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio.com, Spreaker.com, and Tune.com. Together, we reach you up nearly 90 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Check out Roundtable Wednesday, this Wednesday at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific. That's Roundtable Wednesday exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. And don't forget, best VTR 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to our second third of this 90-minute edition of Tomorrow Be Televised, coming away in vivo, live from New Haven, York. Simon Amel with you live from the Big Apple, 81 degrees at the bottom of the hour. Let's hear from you. Give us a call with our upcoming guest. The number you use is 646-652-2906, or use the chat room, Simon Apple 04. But in our superfan from Philadelphia, Rick Webb, has just joined the chat room. Well, just when you thought that TNT was going to be out of the scripted series business, along comes a program called The Lazarus Project. It has become not only a major new success for TNT, but for cable overall, and it's already been renewed for a second season. Joining us live from Brighton, England, an interview exclusive, one of the executive producers of The Lazarus Project, Joe Barton. Joe, congratulations. We're happy to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much, Simon. Pleasure to be on.
A lot of people like the idea that you've taken the time travel idea, the time travel situation, and you've turned it on its ear for the Lazarus Project. Why do you think it's become successful, not only here on in the States on TNT, but elsewhere?
Oh, man, I don't know, really. I mean, it's hard to ever really say why anything is successful or not. You just have to put stuff out there and hope that it sort of connects with people. But I think, you know, one of the things we wanted to do was try and find a new way into a already pretty popular subgenre, which is, you know, time travel drama, and, you know, attempt to sort of do something new with that. We know that people like time travel shows and time loop shows and all that. And we thought if we can find a way of slightly twisting what is a sort of familiar sandbox, there might be an audience for it. And, you know, thankfully, there appears to be.
Did you grow up, or did you, as your career in television was coming together, were any time travel shows that you liked particularly?
Time travel shows, I can't think of, I mean, on British TV, I mean, I like all the sort of obvious time travel movies. I mean, Back to the Future is the obvious one. There's been a sort of rash of good ones in the last few years, you know, everything from Looper. I mean, there was Tenet quite recently, which I can't claim to have, which I enjoyed, but didn't completely understand all of it, but I enjoyed watching it. But they're always good, you know. There was the Palm Springs recently, you know. I just kind of like them all. I think people are just inherently curious about the idea of you know, of that idea of being able to go back in time. I mean, our one's kind of more, it's a little bit more in the, I mean, they advertise it as like being a bit Groundhog Day because it's a sort of more time loop than time travel thing. It's not entirely the same as Groundhog Day, which is obviously he's living, you know, one day again and again. Our one's more, you know, about this group that have the power to turn back time if they need to do it, but they can only ever turn back time to the last 1st of July. So they have the potential, you know, they could turn back time as many times as they want. They could live, you know, that one day again and again if they wanted to, but they only ever use it when the world's in danger to sort of stop apocalyptic events. So it's, there's a sort of little, that's the kind of twist in it. But I think, yeah, people are sort of endlessly fascinated with that idea of being able to relive their past or do things differently or undo their mistakes. I think maybe there's just something inside all of us that that would love to be able to go back and undo all our mistakes. So yeah, I don't know, like it's an element I always like watching.
Yeah. Well, of course, your country is the home of one of the great adventures of both time and space travel, Doctor Who. And here in the United States, we've had the Time Tunnel. We've had Quantum Leap. The revival is now on NBC, and it looks like we'll go into a second season this coming fall. We had Voyagers, and we've had other shows that have had Star Trek, one of their greatest episodes. The original version was The City on the Edge of Forever, which was a time travel, back in time kind of, of course, the Back to the Future movies. And so on. So how did the Lazarus Project start? Who put it together and how did you get involved with it?
Well, I put it together, really. I had the idea, it was a long time ago now. It must have been about, I think 7 years ago or something. So it's been sort of gestating for a while. It was an idea I came up with. I'd been reading about this again. Like it's quite timely sort of idea, but there was this in the Cuban Missile Crisis. There was this it's quite a famous event. There was this Russian nuclear submarine, and they got this sort of unidentified something came over the radar, and they weren't sure whether it was an American, you know, missile launch or not, and they couldn't get in touch with their superiors. So there was this whole debate on this Russian submarine about whether or not they should launch their own nuclear missiles. And obviously, if they had, that would have been, you know, an apocalyptic situation. But thankfully, one member of the crew argued the other members down. They didn't fire their rockets, and disaster was averted. And I was reading about that incident, and it seemed so sort of, it seemed almost odd that we as a species haven't actually, you know, gone there, haven't actually experienced this sort of dire apocalyptic situation. And I sort of had an interest in writing something along the lines of that and bringing these sort of time travel elements. Anyway, it was an old sort of thing. I mean, like I say, the show came out in the UK last year, and before then it was many, many years of development, as these things sometimes are. But it was my idea originally, and then brought producers on and pitched it around the UK, and eventually, you know, as these things sometimes do, managed to get it made. But it's been a long road to the screen.
We are speaking with Joe Barton. He is one of the executive producers of the new TNT series sensation, The Lazarus Project, which is on Sunday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time here in the States. Also, through Sky Studios, being captured and seen all over the world. Joe joins us live from Brighton, England this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised, where it's already prime time where they are. Tom, I'm with you live here in New York. We are still in mid-afternoon here in this neck of the U.S. of A. 81 degrees at the bottom of the hour. Let's hear from you. Give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Two of our superfans, Duck Northwest Media and Rick Webb from Philadelphia, already in the room. Coming away Friday on Tomorrow Be Televised, we'll introduce you to a new organization that's trying to have independent programmers using smart TV sets, smart TV devices, and multi-channel phones to get to you. Give them a bigger break in advertising and affiliation, a whole lot more. It's called the Independent Streaming Association, and we will talk to one of the key people behind it. He's also the co-founder and chief executive officer of the leading ad-supported programming service serving the gay and lesbian community, Reverie, our good friend Damian Pelletioni. That's coming your way Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here exclusively on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Joe, when you think about this series, there's also, in addition to the time travel element, as a very interesting element, because it's an organization that has to intervene with time when the world is somehow getting ready to go with the apocalypse or break up, never to return. But there's also, it seems, a bit of La Femme Nikita in there, where you have at least one of the main characters, George, is sort of having to figure out, is this organization really on my side or not? And there's sort of this, you know, you wonder if there's a lot of clandestine, not only with the situation at hand, but also with the organization that's trying to write things up.
Yeah, man, yeah. I mean, we wanted to get this sort of moral questions in as well. As we were putting the show together, I think whenever you have like a story about a very, very powerful organization, as this one has, you know, this incredible, not like a gift, but it's like this incredible ability that manipulates everybody in the world's lives without them even knowing about it. There's, I think, a very interesting, it's always interesting, I think, to scratch under the surface of that. And, you know, often as writers and producers or whatever, you know, we make shows that are about these big institutions, be they, you know, be it the police or be it the military or whoever. And it's, I mean, historically been tempting to present these institutions and organizations as purely good. You know, they're the good guys. They'll stop the crime. They'll step in. They'll do the thing that needs to be done. And I think what's been interesting over the last couple of years is this idea of actually trying to come up with a more nuanced view of these places and who are these people that are, you know, sort of self-ordained, holding power over the rest of us. And that idea of, well, you know, you may do one thing and say it's for the greater good and say that, you know, we should trust you and do it, but actually what's your agenda and who's, you know, who do you answer to and all these sort of things. So it was kind of, you know, yeah, we just wanted to get that idea that I feel like the sort of basic version would have been presenting, you know, here's the Lazarus Project, they're the good guys, they save the world, so everything they do is good. But actually, isn't it a little bit more interesting to suggest, well, maybe they're not as good as they think they are. Maybe they shouldn't be trusted as much as they want to be. And you know, what are the, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, that old cliche. But that was a sort of idea in terms of making it a bit more interesting and digging into those questions.
Your cast is very diverse and quite interesting, leading off with, I have the name right, Papa Isidu. Who, by the way, is an Emmy Award nominee. He's also a BAFTA nominee. That's sort of the British Academy Awards. He was in a very popular project called I May Destroy You. Talk about getting this cast together and the qualities that the cast brings to their characters who have to deal with, A, this organization, and, B, the fact that at any moment they would have to intervene and shift time.
Yeah, well, we were looking for something very specific with Papa's character, George, in particular, because there's this sort of, we needed someone who was capable of handling all the dramatic stuff. You know, it's a very, you know, there's great sort of grief and there's anguish and there's all these sort of, you know, big, heavy things that he has to do, but he also needed to be funny and relatable. There's quite a sort of, I would say, like, quite a sort of unique tone to the show in terms of it's like serious, but it does also walk a line of occasional, not outright comedy, but there are sort of lighter notes, and we didn't want to get too bogged down in sort of melodrama or anything. So we needed an actor who was charming and who was funny, but could also handle the heft of it. Because the central sort of idea is that this character, George, he becomes a member of the Lazarus Project, and then because he suffers a personal tragedy, his partner is killed in an accident, and he suddenly realizes that the only way of bringing her back is if he manipulates the Lazarus Project into turning back the clock, and the only way he can do that is by setting off a world endangering event. So he kind of becomes almost a villain as the show goes on. It's a sort of kind of Breaking Bad sort of vibe to it in that sense, and so we needed someone who, you know, that just has that sort of magnetism that can kind of take the audience with them. And Papa's just, he's an exceptional actor, and we're incredibly excited to be able to work with him. Like you say, I mean, he's been in I May Destroy You, and he's just been in one of the new Black Mirrors as well. And he's he's going to be a real superstar. So, you know, we were delighted to get him. And the rest of the cast sort of, you know, sitting behind that with that same philosophy. We're looking at actors, you know, Ajay Mahindra and Charlie Clive, Caroline Quentin, some, you know, people who have maybe, I don't know how well-known in the States, but well-known in the UK, and they have sort of, some of them have more of a comedy background. So we really wanted to get that, you know, good actors that could do the drama, but could also do the lightness of touch, which is actually tricky. You know, it's hard to find them sometimes. But yeah, we got a good bunch.
Mm-hmm. For people who haven't seen the series, what qualifies as a threat of extinction, and how far back or how far ahead in time does the Lazarus Project go to try to settle things, to resolve the situation?
Well, the most they can ever go back is a year. So it sort of works on a kind of checkpoint idea, like in a computer game. So they have this machine which will turn back time, but can only ever go back to the last 1st of July. So if they use the machine on the 2nd of July, you would go back one day to the last 1st of July, which is yesterday. Then, you know, if you, you know, use it on the 3rd of July, you go back 2 days to the 1st of July, and so on and so on. If you go an entire year and get to the next 1st of July, then that becomes the new checkpoint, and you can't go any further back than that. So those are the kind of rules of it. And in terms of, like, apocalyptic, what constitutes an apocalyptic or world-ending situation, I mean, we've gone for the classics, you know, a lot of talk of nuclear war. There's a pandemic. We, you know, wrote this in, like, a long time before COVID-19, and ended up filming it during lockdown, and so we had this whole sort of life imitating art kind of situation. We also had a whole subplot about a nuclear warhead in Russia and Ukraine, and we had to go back and change all these references because that suddenly became obviously very relevant. So there's lots of stuff that we've gone for that have sort of disturbingly ended up being quite close to home. But yeah, we've gone for all the sort of things you'd expect for world endangering scenarios.
So is there sort of a rip from the headlines approach, the kind that Dick Wolf has popularized in his series, the Law and Order series, Chicago series, the FBI series, where you're able to comment in a way on present-day matters?
Well, I mean, I guess so. Like I say, I mean, we found ourselves dealing with situations that ended up, you know, that they were happening at the same time. We wrote a pandemic episode, and we wrote a you know, nuclear war in Russia Ukraine thing, and you know, so it ended up being a lot more close to home than we thought. I mean, you know, whenever you do try and comment on you know, what feel like contemporary issues and what feel like contemporary problems, and but you know, the length of time it takes to make a TV show, you know, by the time you write this thing, then it comes out like 3 years later, so you've no idea. It's just kind of coincidence, to be honest, that it feels quite ripped from the headlines.
Mm-hmm. The next episode of The Lazarus Project premieres this Sunday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time on TNT, available on cable and satellite all over the U.S. of A. It's also running through Sky Studios in other parts of the globe. And we've got Joe Barton. He's one of the executive producers of the series, live from Brighton, England, this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Tom, I'm with you live from New Haven, New York. Thank you for joining us on this Monday. And we thank you for kicking your week off with us. If you have a question or comment, meeting with Joe, make that call, 646-652-2906, or join the chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Coming up before the top of the hour, our new classic trivia question. We're going for our second weekly win in a row. It could be you, so get your thinking caps on. And then at the top of the hour, we'll be joined by Cav Sengenis. He is the host and originator of the growing popular YouTube attraction 13 Week Theater that deals with shows that had a short life on the air. And I think he'll be very interested in some of the shows he has covered in the years he's been doing that series. It's quite a good series, and I've had a chance to discover it over the last couple of weeks, and I'm delighted that Pab can come on. You'll hear him after the top of the hour. Joe, Rod Serling used to say that when he did The Twilight Zone, that science fiction was a great way to showcase the human condition. What about the human condition, where it's at and where we might be going? Are you hoping, you and your colleagues, hope that the Lazarus Project shows?
What about the human condition? Oh, my God. That's a big question. what about the human condition? Well, I guess it's – I mean, but the thing that we really wanted to do with the show was make a morality tale in a way. I mean, it's all about – I guess if you boil it down, it's all about what would you do to – save one person's life. Yeah, it's that. I mean, it's like a class. You know, it's the trolley problem, or whatever. Like, you know, you know, do you save? You kill one person to save 100. But what are the morality? You know, what's the morality of that? We ask questions like that, and we try and use the time travel sort of thing that we've got going on to ask, like, you know, if you do terrible things, but those things then get undone by a time machine, are they still? Were they still bad? You know, they still happened. You still did them, but now they've been undone. You know, is it moral to undo time if you're gonna, you know, change the course of billions of people's lives, even if those people don't know that you've done that? They may have, you know, you undo children, you undo families, you can undo social movements, you know, you do all this stuff, but people don't know it. Is it, you know, is it moral or not? And those are the kind of questions that we wanted to sort of dig into. But I think ultimately, you know, I think TV and film and all this, but it's always more interesting if you can find a sort of human and character way in, rather than just, you know, the version of this, which would have been apocalyptic scenario of the week, and the kind of the more sort of action thriller version. But yeah, it's, you know, we try to anchor it in the human condition and ask those big questions.
I understand that you've wrapped up the second season of Lazarus Project, and we'll let everybody know when that is going to be running on TNT. As you get deeper and deeper, if you have additional seasons to work with, what about the consequences of altering time that you haven't explored yet would you like to explore? Whether it is, as you like said, how does one iota that you change or alter or shift impacts millions, perhaps billions of people? Or get into more of the value of time, the value of traveling back forth to rearrange things. What are the limits? Are there limits? Are limits in certain conditions and not in others?
Yeah, man. Well, you know, like I say, I mean, the first series, definitely, those are the big questions. Like, what is actually, what are the moral implications? You know, and George, who goes on this journey, and he ends up doing all these sort of awful things in this attempt to turn back time so that his girlfriend can come back to life. And his justification is that for every bad thing I do, every person I murder, every rule I break, if I'm successful, then that'll all get undone, right? So what does it matter? And the counter-argument is, you know, well, you're playing God, and we show in the series, you know, the ways that can affect people, you know, babies, you know, who were born, not being born, all that kind of stuff. And that's the sort of, that's the big one for the first series. I mean, without wanting to sort of get into spoilers or anything, but the second series is, which we're in post-production on now, it's much more of a straight time travel show in some ways. So we explore, you know, what happens when characters go back, you know, and experience events from many years prior. And, you know, I always, you know, the thing I always love from Groundhog Day, my favorite scene from Groundhog Day was when he, Bill Murray and Andy McDowell have that, like, great date. And, like, it's brilliant, and everything they do is romantic and have this great connection. And then the next day he tries to recreate it beat by beat and do the same thing, you know, have a snowball fight, make a snowman, all this stuff. And it just doesn't work the second time. It's this sort of idea that, well, it's just, I don't know, the timing's off, or it's not quite, he doesn't quite say the line right, or whatever it is, and everything that worked the day before doesn't work the next day. And that idea of, well, how many of your relationships are based on human connection and moments, and how many of those relationships actually, if you went back in time and relived those moments, would they be the same with the people that you know, your partner that you're with now still be your partner if you went back and met them for the same time, or your friends, or whatever, all these kind of ideas that our lives are made up by these very small sort of, you know, billion to one connections, and how much of that is actually fluid or not. I think so. Anyway, so that's kind of the stuff we're looking at in the second series.
Yeah. Joe, before you go, what reaction from the audience watching on TNT do you and everybody involved in this series appreciate the most?
Well, we like positivity. We like it when they applaud. I don't know, man. Like, it's nice, you know. With anything, you know, you put it out into the world, and you hope that people like it. But I suppose you hope that people get something from it. And I think we did, you know, we wanted to, with this show, we wanted to have it as a, you know, we wanted it to be like an intelligent genre show. So I guess if people, you know, interact with the sort of questions it's asking, the moral questions, we see people sort of saying, well, what would I do in that situation? I guess that's the best reaction, you know, because people are really sort of putting themselves in the shoes of the character and sort of asking those difficult questions of themselves. And I think there's no really right or wrong answer. It's kind of always fascinating to hear from people like, oh, if that was me, I'd do this or I'd do that or whatever. But yeah, man, like, you know, you make something and all you can ever hope is that people, A, watch it, but B, just, I don't know, think about it for at least 5 minutes after it's ended. And if it has some effect on them, whether it's good or bad, then great, then you're doing your job.
The Lazarus Project, a co-production of Urban Myth Films and Sky Studios. First season is now running on TNT here in the U.S. of A. Sunday night, the next episode, 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time. Check your local listings where TNT is available in your area on cable and satellite. For more details about the series online, go to www.tntdrama.com. That's www.tntdrama.com. The second season of Lazarus Project is now in a post-production, and we'll let you know when that runs on TNT in the near future. Once again, The Lazarus Project, Sundays, 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific time on TNT, available all throughout the United States on cable and satellite. Joe Barton, one of the executive producers of the series, thank you for joining us. Congratulations to you, your colleagues, everybody involved with Lazarus on a great first season and the second season renewal, and hopefully many, many more to come. It's been a delight to have you on live from England.
Oh, thank you very much, Simon. Pleasure to talk to you.
Same here. Take care. Enjoy the week.
Thanks, man. Bye.
Joe Bourne, executive producer of The Lazarus Project, Internet Radio exclusive live from Brighton, England. Now it's time for our classic trivia question of the week. We introduced the question last week. We're going for our second weekly winner in a row, and it could be you. And if it is you, you're going to win from AMC Networks an Uber card. That's right, an Uber card. And that could be yours if you know the answer to this question. Who played Gidget on The New Gidget? That's the syndicated version of Gidget. The first one was the ABC version starring Sally Field. The new version in syndication appeared from 1986 to 1988 on local stations syndicated by Columbia Pictures Television. Who played Gidget on The New Gidget? If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. That's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Remember to enclose your name and your mailing address when you send that email. And if we don't get a winner by the end of today, we'll post the question tomorrow on Facebook and on Twitter. It's Facebook at Simon Applebaum and Twitter at UBC Simon, TWBT. Once again, the question, who played Gidget on The New Gidget? If your first email name that correct answer, an Uber card from AMC Network will be yours. And again, if we don't get a winner by the end of today, post the question tomorrow on Facebook and on Twitter. Facebook at Simon Applebaum, Twitter at UBC Simon, TWBT. Remember, in order to win, you got to play in, and all the very best. You're listening to Marvin Televised. We are the long-running audio promo podcast. We're wrapping up year 16 this month, and we're with you usually Mondays and Fridays, 3 p.m. Eastern New Pacific on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and Tuner Radio. You can also find us on our website, tomorrowbetelevised.com. And now we're available on more than 20 top podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Odyssey, Verbal, Spotify, the Zencastr Creator Network, and many, many more. So do check us out. We go on podcast immediately after each episode wraps up live. Don't forget, coming away 1 week from Monday, we will have the prolific producer, director of episodic television, and the executive producer and showrunner of the new Justified sequel, City Primeval, which premieres next week on FX and then on Hulu, Michael Dinner. It's Michael Dinner, executive producer and showrunner of Justified, City Primeval, reuniting people from the original cast of that Peabody and Emmy Award-winning series. He'll be with us live as our lead guest from England a week from today, exclusively here on Tomorrow Be Televised. When we come back, we will have someone who has made a habit of showcasing the short life of individual TV shows. You may be very surprised about how some of these series got on the air and then got off the air pretty quick. It's 13-Week Theater, the pop YouTube attraction, and Pam Sengenis, he is the host and originator. He joins me live from Bradford, Pennsylvania, after we pause at the top of the hour for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio.com, speaker.com, and tune.com, together reaching nearly 90 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Looking for an interesting musical experience? How about the Greg and Sophia Vibe? That's this Thursday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific. The Greg and Sophia Vibe on BTR Thursday, 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific, exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. And don't forget, that's BTR always 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to our final 30 minutes of Tomorrow Be Televised, and we welcome those of you just joining us at the top of the hour. Tom Alba, I'm with you live from Nueva York, 82 degrees top of the hour, mostly cloudy here in the Big Apple. Happy to have you aboard, and we would like to have you be part of the program. It's so simple. You have a question or comment for our final guest today, give us a call. Here's the number, 646-652-2906. It's 646-652-2906. That number is good anywhere you're catching us across the country or around the world. You're on Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, or TuneIn Radio. And we can also take your questions and feedback through the chat room. Simon Apple 04 by name, Duck Northwest Media, and Rick Webb, two of our great super fans, are with us in the room. So join them. And as soon as I see your question or feedback is ready to go, we'll bring it to our guests. And don't forget, you can connect others over the next half hour by using Facebook Timeline. Click on that Facebook icon, your Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, TuneIn screen. Follow the instruction of doing live with you. Have you ever wondered why some television series can run 10, 20 years, like Gunsmoke or Law & Order, and why some, even some that have great ideas, beautifully executed, only last a season or less, and in some cases maybe just one or two episodes? Well, that question is now being answered on a regular series of featurettes on YouTube called 13 Week Theater. They're marvelously done. And right now, we're going to meet the person who puts it together. Joining us live from Bradford, Pennsylvania, the host and originator of 13 Week Theater, Tab Zinjanis. Tab, it's great to have you here.
It's great to be on your show, Simon. Thanks for having me.
You're very, very welcome, Tab. First of all, why do you think people are clicking your series? What about your series do they like?
Well, it's kind of interesting. A lot of people ended up growing up around the same time I did and watching all of these shows that, for one reason or another, just suddenly disappeared. One of the first shows I really noticed just suddenly disappearing was a sitcom called Best of the West starring Joel Higgins. And as a kid, I was wondering, gee, I liked this show. I know a lot of people who like this show. Why did it end up disappearing? And it's going to be down the road as a subject of 13 Week Theater, so I don't want to give too much away. But basically that one and a number of other shows were killed this way. It was that the network dragged their heels on renewing it. And by the time they were ready to renew it, in this case, Joel Higgins had already moved on and shot the pilot for Silver Spoons, which ended up being a lot more lucrative, so Best of the West ended up being canceled. And growing up, I remembered a lot of the shows that stuck with me and just for one reason or another didn't. Then when I was in college at St. Bonaventure University back in 1990-1991, our cable system picked up, then it was called CTV. Later on, it would eventually morph into Comedy Central. And they had so little programming that every afternoon, they had a block of failed sitcoms. And my friends and I jokingly started calling it 13 Week Theater. And when the time came and I decided, you know, why don't I start doing a YouTube show about some of these shows and find out exactly why they didn't last, the title was there for me and I ran with it.
In watching a lot of your work with these different programs, and you've covered over the years a wide variety of shows, it's not always the case that it's because the show is badly executed or even bad viewership. There's a lot of interesting elements that got in the way of some of these shows really making it. For example, one of your latest installments is about the NBC series Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which was created by Aaron Sorkin, featured a lot of people from the West Wing. It was a sort of a parody on Saturday Night Live and sort of a show within a show. And the interesting thing about the point you made in that is a lot of people think that show was a bomb in terms of viewership. It wasn't. In fact, as you mentioned, down the stretch, that show actually gained viewership after it had dipped, after the first few segments. And yet, why did it get canceled?
Well, the interesting thing is that NBC panicked during the dip and they started calling for a lot of changes, like cast changes. They ended up writing out two of the original characters, and they greatly cut back on the number of sketch comedy bits, which led to other actors not being used as often, and they wanted more changes and more changes, and the show eventually was nothing like what it had set out to be. Also, it had some competition in the form of 30 Rock, which was a sitcom about a show like Saturday Night Live, whereas Studio 60 was a drama about a show similar to Saturday Night Live. And Studio 60, actually, at the beginning, it was the top-rated new show of that season. It got 26 million viewers its first week. The problem was, when it came down to the end, NBC was only going to renew one of the two shows, and while Studio 60 had higher ratings, it was a very expensive show to produce, and 30 Rock, if you measured dollars per viewer, 30 Rock was the better deal, so they renewed 30 Rock and canceled Studio 60, and the rest is history.
How many of these 13-week theaters have you done, and when you decide to focus on a particular show, how long does it take to put an episode together?
Let's see. I think I just finished episode number 65. I'm working on number 66. How long from concept is really a completely arbitrary thing, because there are some shows, like I mentioned, Best of the West, that I wanted to do from the outset, but for the longest time, they were pretty much lost media. There was nothing that you could find out there easily accessible, and so I didn't get to do them. One great example that I did get to do is one of the most notorious TV shows in history, Jackie Gleason's panel game, You're in the Picture.
Mm-hmm.
Aired for one episode January 20th, 1961, and Gleason hated it so much, and I don't want to spoil too much, but one of the panelists actually quit the show after rehearsal, and they had to replace him on the panel for the actual show. Gleason ended up hating it that the next week he just sat there on the stage, live television, and spent 30 minutes apologizing for how bad the show was and going off about the whole show. And the next week, he just sat there with his friend Art Carney, interviewed him for a half hour, and they burned off his contract with just him interviewing people. For the longest of times, it was only available at the Paley Center in New York City, but someone leaked both episodes, the actual episode and the apology, to the Internet Archive. And so I went and I finally did it. Another one that is really notorious is Mary Tyler Moore's variety show from 1978, right after the Mary Tyler Moore show ended. She did a variety show, and the cast of this was amazing. It had Dick Shawn, Swoozie Kurtz, Michael Keaton. Her announcer was David Letterman. That's how big this cast was. And CBS cut it after three episodes. The ratings were that bad. Now, again, this was not available, but I finally got my hands on 2 1/3 worth of the three episodes. So I'm right now working on Mary. The actual production process, it takes about 2 weeks for me to write a script and then select footage and edit. I tend to work on two episodes at once, except sometimes when real life invades, I don't have a chance to do that, and I'll have to take a week off like I'm doing this week. But when I do that, I try to make the next episode memorable. So right now I'm working on Mary, and I'm going to follow that right up with compared to it's another predecessor of Studio 60. After her variety show flopped later that season, they had her do a one-hour sitcom combined with a variety show about behind the scenes of a bad variety show, a kind of Larry Sanders of the 1970s, and that lasted 11 episodes and also failed, so I'm going to be tackling that the week afterward.
What we're talking about is 13 Week Theater. It is a very popular and growing YouTube attraction. It's available 24/7 on YouTube, which, by the way, you can now also catch on smart TV sets and smart devices. And we're talking with the host and originator of this series. It takes a look at shows that, for one reason or another, had a very short life, sometimes way short. And that's Pabs and Jerris. He joins us live from Bradford, Pennsylvania, this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Happy you're with us this Monday afternoon. Simon Abbott, I'm with you live from New York, 83 degrees as we get to quarter past the hour. If you question or comment on our interview with Pab, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name, Duck Northwest Media, and Rick Webb, our superfan from Philadelphia, already in the room. Don't forget, coming up Friday on Tomorrow Be Televised, among our guests, we'll have the co-founder and chief executive officer of the ad-supported gay and lesbian plumbing service, Reverie Damian Pelliccioni. We'll talk to him about his involvement in a brand-new project called the Independent Streaming Alliance, which is trying to encourage independent programmers of smart TV set and smart TV device content to get together on all sorts of situations. And then 1 week from today, from the new FX series Justified, City Primeval, prolific producer-director of episodic television, the executive producer and showrunner on this series, Michael Dinner, that's coming your way Friday and next Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, exclusively here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Pab, of the 65 episodes you've done, which one or two have become like the audience favorites?
The audience favorites vary. I think my top viewed one is on the 1980 season of Saturday Night Live, which I took the liberty of counting that because they actually changed the name of the show for that season to Saturday Night Live 80. So I took a look at that version of the cast, the second cast, completely new producer, completely new a writing staff, and a lot of the Saturday Night Live fans seem to have latched onto that. Another popular one was I did one on Life with Lucy, which was Lucy's failed 1985 comeback sitcom, which that was a show snake bit from the beginning. Recently, I got a lot of response out of doing Mel Brooks's When Things Were Rotten, which was essentially a weekly version of Robin Hood Man in Tights. And that one is another good example because, just like Studio 60, the network was happy with the ratings, but the show was too expensive. And in this case, they wanted Mel Brooks to switch to a four-camera videotape setup and cut the budget of the show considerably, and he said no, he wasn't going to compromise his art, so he ended up pulling the plug after the first season. He could have gotten renewed, but he chose not to because it would have compromised the show too much, he thought.
How much support do you get from the Paley Center for Media in New York and Los Angeles or other organizations, the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, organizations that have a whole episodes and clips that you might be able to use?
None, honestly. I've never approached them, and I've never been approached. About as close as I'm about to come is I'm reaching out to George Schlatter to try to get permission to use bits of an interview that he did about Turn On, which was a show that was actually canceled in the middle of the first episode, and in many markets, after the first commercial break, it never came back. There's one good example of not really wanting to work with other people too much. When I did my one on Pink Lady and Jeff, I reached out to one of those organizations who had an interview with Sid and Marty Krofft talking about the show, and I wanted to use 15 seconds of footage from it. And they said, okay, that'll be $6,000. And I went, no, thank you. So I ended up not using that footage.
Have you heard, by the way, Marty Krofft was on our show a number of years ago when he and Sid did their first series for Nickelodeon. which ran with Cesar Millan, the Dog Whisperer, which ran several seasons, very successful for them. Once you do a 13-week theater episode, do you hear back, let's say, from the cast members on that show or the producers or executive producers and others? Do you get any feedback from them saying along the lines of either, hey, you did a great job, you really captured, you know, what our show was about and why we went off the air so quickly, or, you know, oh, you screwed the facts up, whatever?
Only a couple of times. One, I was doing, I can't even remember which UPN show it was, but I mentioned that their first shows other than Star Trek were flops like Platypus Man starring Richard Jenny, and someone reached out to me saying, I was on that show. When you're ready to do Platypus Man, call me and we'll talk. So when I get ready to do that, I will let him know. The other two great examples is I did one on the New Monkees, and I ended up hearing and getting friended on Facebook by two of the New Monkees, Dino Kovas and Marty Ross. They loved that I actually didn't run their show over the coals, that I actually thought it was a good show, just poorly envisioned and poorly executed. But my favorite is I did one on the Brady Bunch Variety Hour, and within the first 24 hours, I got a comment from Jerry Rochelle, the actress who played Fake Jan, saying, thank you for pronouncing my name right. This was totally groovy. And then she's hung out ever since in the comments section, answering questions from fans who've approached her and have praised her. So that for me made it all the worthwhile. I've not really heard back from other people when I've done their show, but I think it's just that I'm not on their radar. I'm not big enough yet.
Mm.
If you've seen your show, I know there are a couple of things. One, you've probably done every post-Brady Bunch show involving the Brady clan, because I know you had the Brady Brides and you had the Brady's, the dramatic series that was done for CBS. You also
did them as part
of
a
programs
very
that were
Halloween,
trying to
actually
Americanize Fawlty Towers. One with B. Arthur, Amanda, and then the one with John Larroquette, Payne.
Oh, yeah. And I do have some footage in there of another attempt at an American Fawlty Towers, which was a failed pilot with Betty White and Harvey Korman. So you can get a look at some of that in, I think it's in the Amanda's episode that I use most of that. But, yeah, American shows based on British shows, that's an obvious target. One of my favorites was Going the Other Way Around with the British version of That 70s Show, where basically they had no idea what they were doing. Even though it was the same producers of the American show behind it, they had no idea what made That 70s Show work, and what did work didn't work in Britain.
When you determine what show you will do when, because you've covered a wide variety, in these 65 episodes, you've covered comedy, you've covered dramas, you've covered dramedies, you've covered variety shows, you've covered science, you've covered genre shows. When do you determine, like, all right, this is, I'm going to do this now?
I've got a list of shows that I want to do sooner or later, and they keep getting moved around. Quite often, it's not until I start writing the script a given week that I finally decide what's coming up. One good example was the Mary coming out of Studio 60. I was going to follow a link from Studio 60. Evan Handler was one of the writers on the show within a show, and I was getting ready to do his show, Whoops, which was a sitcom about the only survivors of a nuclear holocaust from Fox. But when the chance to do the Mary shows came in, I decided I have to do these right now, so I put aside what little I prepped for Whoops and I will get to that in a few weeks. Another great example is one that just came out of nowhere, and I ran with it. Back near the beginning, I was laying some groundwork to do Pink Lady and Jeff, and I started looking for footage of Donnie and Marie, which was Sid and Marty Krofft's really big variety show hit. But then I came across the Jerry Lewis Show, his late night talk show from 1985, which has to be one of the worst things I've ever seen. And I decided, okay, let's push all this aside. I have to do this one right now. And quite often it's just, all right, let me look at the list. What do I feel like? Oh, okay, we'll do this one next. The good thing is because I have a Patreon where I post everything a week before it goes on YouTube, I have a chance to promote what's coming up on YouTube because I know what I've just posted to Patreon.
In a moment, I'm going to share with Pav four ideas for upcoming 13-week theaters. And if you have some ideas, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Remember, if you want to catch up on episodes you missed, go to our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. That's blogtalkradio.com/televised. Check out our website, tomorrowbetelevised.com, available 24/7. Or go to our podcast. More than 20 podcast sites now take our show, from Odyssey to Zencaster to Verbal to Podbean to Player.fm, and they do appreciate your support. Okay, Pav, I've put together four shows which I think would make great segments for upcoming 13-week theaters. And I'm curious to see what they're on your list. All right, here's number one. Remember The Star Lost?
No, I don't.
The Star Lost was a science fiction series created by Harlan Ellison, probably one of the most brilliant science fiction writers for both stories and television. It was put together in syndication by 20th Century Fox in the early 1970s on the NBC television stations. It was running Saturday 7 o'clock, starred Keir DeLay, coming off 2001 Space Odyssey. This was a show that had a lot of things supposedly for it, and it made a lot of crazy mistakes, and it was out after 17 episodes.
All right. Second here.
And you can see the, and by the way, episodes are on YouTube.
Yeah, I was just checking to see if there is footage out there. Okay, yeah, I'm a big fan of the guy I call Unca Harlan. I believe in a lot of his philosophy, especially Pay the Writer, and I've always loved his writing and his Take No Prisoners attitude, so I will definitely look into that one.
Yeah. It's a great example of a show that had so much promise, and a lot of things working for it should have worked for it, and it didn't because of a lot of bad decisions that were made in terms of executing the show. Second, a wonderful Western from Rod Serling that was on in 1965 on CBS, ran about half a season, called The Loner, starring Lloyd Bridges as a former Civil War soldier who is trying to sort of find himself in the New West. It's a marvelously done show. CBS hated it because Rod Serling wanted it to be a show that did not focus on violence in a Western, and it provoked a big public battle. And, again, you can catch episodes on YouTube.
I thought about that one once or twice. Rod Serling was a notoriously hard person to work with, so that one kind of writes itself.
Yeah. This was a great show. Of course, Rod passed away in 1975. This was, I think, a very underrated Western. Number three, The Next Step Beyond. You ever see One Step Beyond?
I've heard of
The Next
Step Beyond,
yes. Was in the time of prime access, when you had a lot of shows in syndication in that 7 to 8 o'clock hour, five nights a week, different shows on local stations. John revived, along with a lot of people that did the original One Step Beyond, The Next Step Beyond, and it was a show that was done first on videotape, then on film. There's an interview somewhere he did on YouTube, talked about it. I think it would make a great episode because this is a show that you wish could have been better than it was.
Okay, I'm making a note of that one, too.
And finally, have you thought about doing a game show?
I've been trying to avoid game shows because they tend to, if they don't run for freaking ever, like Wheel of Fortune, God help us,
yeah,
they tend to not run very long. Which one are you talking about? I think I might know.
Well, it's one that I watched when I was a student at American University in 1970. It's called Musical Chairs. It was the first hosted by an African-American named Adam Wade. He did a marvel. He's a wonderful singer, terrific, terrific talent. It was a show produced in New York at the Ed Sullivan Theater. It was put together by Don Kirshner, in part, and it ran about 90 episodes, about 3 or 4 months. And it's a shame. It was a wonderful show that had a lot of great talent on it. It was like a combination game show, variety show, with great talents like Sister Sledge, The Spinners, Larry Kurth, the original 20 West Side Story, Ernestine Jackson was in the Broadway musical at Brazen. It was a wonderful show. And because of the fact it was put in different time periods around the country, it could not get an audience. And it was also the only game show that Kraft sponsored down late in the run. They actually did a sponsorship, which was not the usual thing at time for game shows. I think it would be a wonderful story to look at, Musical Chairs.
All right. One I've considered doing as a game show is a notorious one. It was based out of Canada, but for American audiences, it was called Pitfall, and it was hosted by Alex Trebek. And they had a really elaborate, expensive set where if a player stepped on the pitfall space, they actually had the set lower them down to the lower level, and then they had to answer a certain question right. It was poorly conceived, a bad idea, and it ended up that Alex Trebek later on said, well, they canceled the show because they ran out of money. I never even got paid.
Yeah. The production company was Catalina Productions. It was syndicated by Rose, which had done Hollywood Squares at the time. And, yeah, it was – actually, it could have worked. There were some things I liked about it. I've seen the episodes. I liked the premise, but unfortunately the set was a problem, but also the production company did not have the money, and it killed the show.
And Alex Trebek was pretty big in Canada at the time. It was before he was really, really big here in America, but that meant that he was going to cost them quite a bit, and they might have wanted to go a little cheaper.
For sure. The program is 13-Week Theater. You can find it regularly on YouTube. New episodes come out regularly as well. If you want more details about the show, just go and see it for yourself. It's www.youtube.com. Don't forget, YouTube is also available on smart TV sets and smart devices. And if you want to become someone who supports the show financially, do it through a Patreon membership. Go to www.patreon.com. That's www.patreon.com. And your dollars will go to making future episodes of the series well worth watching. Pabst and Dennis, thank you so much for coming on. Congratulations on 13-Week Theater. It is a marvelous, marvelous YouTube feature, and I highly recommend to anybody who loves television. And I really appreciate you coming on, and all the very best going forward.
Thanks for the kind words, and thanks for having me on.
You're welcome, Pab. Take care. Enjoy the week. Pabst and Jen is joining us live from Bradford, Pennsylvania. Thanks to all of our guests for being on. Thanks to all of you for tuning in. Don't forget, coming up Friday, we will have Damian Pelliccioni from Reverie, and next Monday, Michael Dinner from Justified City Crime Evil. Remember, if you came in late today's program, want to catch up on episodes you missed, go to the homepage, go to tomorrowbetelevised.com, and go to our podcast site. And remember, we love hearing from you, so email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. Find me on social media, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. I do respond to your emails in 24 hours. Because what you say matters now more than ever. The views expressed are those of the participants, not those of Blog Talk Radio and other distributors of this program. Andy Cho is B-Cho's general manager. Jay Sonnenberg is head of content. But tomorrow we televise. I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for your listening. Have a great rest of your week. We're back on Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific. You know where? Blog Talk Radio, Speakerton Radio, and all of our web and podcast destinations. Whatever you do now and then, make it safe and make it great. And happy birthday, Noah. Until the next time, stay well and stay tuned.